Daniel, you're challenging the Congressional Task Force on the Declassification of Federal Secrets, headed by Representative Luna and Representative Borchette, to do a real investigation of covert operations. What do you want their hearings to focus on?
This is very interesting because I guess people who are deep researchers, like myself, around this have waited for Congress to investigate these kinds of things. And we finally got this declass committee. And they came out with big promise. They said, we're going to declassify federal secrets, and we're going to do it in a fashion that's transparent to the public. Now, some of the things that have happened in relation to this, they have released over 80,000 records in the JFK assassination, for example. But I've pointed out to them that the most important records, for example, the records concerning George Joannides, who was their top psychological warfare officer, never got released. So you're getting the transparency, but you're not getting the real sort of juicy parts. And what the challenge to the committee is, as these hearings are going on, and they end in the fall, so it's a limited window, and there's a kind of history of this limited window thing. You get enough done in that period of time, and that's it. So the challenge for us now is when they are looking at things like the JFK assassination, the assassination of the political structures from the deep state in the 1960s, all the way through the 80s into the 2000s, and the various deep events in American history, by the time we get to today with what they're bringing out, if they're just going to bring out, oh, you know, there may have been some mafia people involved, there may have been the Cubans involved, but the government covered up because they needed to at the time, then that's the fake story. That's not a declassification committee. Because if you're just looking at this, you know, for example, the government can go in and change an autopsy as they did in President Kennedy's death. The mafia can't change an autopsy. And they can't influence the national media to go to sleep. So we need to take these things for what they literally are. Now, the Declass Committee is also going into the RFK assassination, who was going to be president. Of course, that's the Attorney General, who was President Kennedy's brother, who got assassinated, also under mysterious circumstances. So once we go from there, then we get to the UFO file. That's the other piece. So they're working on all three. That's the D-Class Committee, and it's headed up by Representative Luna of Florida, Anna Luna, and Tim Burchett of Tennessee, both of them making big noises about we're being transparent and all the rest of it. But as we go along tonight, we're going to find out that counterintelligence people have crept into those committees and are now running those committees. So they're at a pivotal point. So this broadcast that we're doing is literally a response to the D-Class Committee saying, you're going off the rails. Here is where you should be looking. And we'll see, we'll make that case on this tonight.
Beautiful. How is executive action, assassination related to black budget exotic technology, and is the classification of this activity included in Executive Order 14176?
That executive order is very important. It just came out in 2025 from this new administration coming in and saying the government needs to declassify these federal secrets. So that is a wide berth in terms of what can happen and what needs to be declassified. So all the records pertaining to the secret activity around assassination in the case of the JFK assassination and Robert Kennedy's assassination and the MLK assassination. So you see, there's some acknowledgement on the government side that yes, all of these things are related. There is an assassination program. So that brings us into what is executive action? Well, executive action is something that was developed by the Central Intelligence Agency to remove a foreign leader if it became in the purpose of the United States. So someone in Guatemala was giving us a hard time. We go in there, size up the situation.
Cambodia.
Yes. Can we bribe him or do we have to take him out? In Iran, all the way back in 1953, we installed someone named Mossadegh. And he, you know, instead of doing what the Central Intelligence Agency wanted, he created an entire situation where he nationalized the oil fields. So we decided we need to take him out, and unceremoniously we removed the same guy that we put in. And this happened at a series of countries over across the world from right after World War II. It continues on until today. So it was particularly apparent when they set it up, though, how, you know, how much fingerprints of the Central Intelligence Agency were on this. One of the things that we need to do is look at executive action and say, did they turn the executive action committee and that propensity into the United States? Did they take executive action and use it to remove the president of the United States all the way back in 1963? That's declassification. That's what the order states that we need to be doing. So executive action is something that goes very deep in the history, and it is completely illegal, which is another part of this, which is a problem, because when we set up the national security state through the National Security Act, there's a charter in there for the Central Intelligence Agency that goes something like this. If the Central Intelligence Agency or its various connections are found to have been committing unlawful acts, they cannot be prosecuted. We never get to look at that charter in the public, and this is part of the problem. So at a certain point, they were off the hook. And when you were looking at Eisenhower administration into the Kennedy administration, the Central Intelligence Agency had started to usurp the power of that overt government by presenting the covert government usurping the public government. So this is where we stood at that time. By the time you get into the Kennedy presidency, he is looking at all this. And immediately when he gets into the presidency, it is the Bay of Pigs that the Central Intelligence Agency, an invasion of Cuba, that they've hoisted upon him. And so instantly he realizes, oh, I've been tricked, and the Central Intelligence Agency is trying to use me to get into a war in Cuba. And he fires the sacred cows in intelligence, including Ellen Dulles and all the rest, who have set up everything from the OSS, the Central Intelligence Agency, and he's been in charge of the Central Intelligence Agency since 1953. So Dulles was a core figure in setting this up. And what we'll find when Kennedy is assassinated is that Dulles is the person who oversees the Warren Commission. So Kennedy fired him. He gets assassinated, and then they call him in to basically cover it up. So this is the nature of executive action. Its foundations in the Central Intelligence Agency, they used it to remove President Kennedy, and then they used it for the cover-up after the fact. So, in fact, the D-Class Committee with the executive order has the power to say the Central Intelligence Agency did a deep state revolt against the presidency, and now, as an agency, we either dissolve it or we acknowledge it and move on. But you can't remain in that space of pretending it didn't happen or that it was the mafia or something else like we were talking about.
Right.
And what they came up with, and we'll talk about this tonight, which is Lee Harvey Oswald is a lone gunman, is absurd, because I'm going to show you tonight actual testimony from the police in the very beginning, who said that what they found wasn't even Oswald's rifle. They found a totally different rifle at the scene of the crime. And that's part of what we want to enter into the actual congressional record on this.
What is X-Protect, and who are the figures involved through recent history who were silenced as witnesses by this group to keep all the wall of secrecies in place?
Well, X-Protect is something we've identified. And it's a group inside the Central Intelligence Agency that works around exotic technology. So there's a wing in there that deals specifically with that. This goes all the way back to a physicist in the 1950s named Robert Sarbarker, sort of accidentally spoke to an interviewer and was saying, oh yeah, the major subject that we keep at a higher level than nuclear secrecy is UFO secrecy. So the technology that was involved with UFOs, and there's a number of things to track there, whether you're talking about if you think it's an off-world visitation or if it's just very advanced technology that we developed through the Nazi period and others where we just usurped the technology and applied it, however you want to look at it, and I'm inclined to think it's some combination of all of the above, but it became the top national security secret for a reason, which is there's a capacity to it that gives a country kind of an unlimited power. And they didn't want to share that the same way they didn't want to share the nuclear secrecy in the beginning. So the UFO file becomes kind of core in the middle of this. The group that's set up to sort of punish those who reveal those secrets or destroy their reputations or ultimately assassinate them, this is the group X-Protect. It comes directly out of the intelligence wing, but it operates between the aerospace companies who are public, not government, and the intelligence agencies who are part of the intelligence community and the apparatus therein. So they're able to operate in this kind of haze between the two. It's an unusual kind of a dark corridor, you could say, between the two. And what happened is when people have stumbled into that corridor, so figures like Judge Jim Garrison, for example, is the only DA who prosecuted a case in the Kennedy murder. You know, very famously, Dorothy Kilgallen, who was a journalist, who understood things in relation to the UFO file, but she was a very popular journalist in that period of time. She was on TV, you know, she was on game shows. I mean, she was ubiquitous. And then suddenly she died very mysteriously after interviewing Jack Ruby, who, you know, famously shot Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin in the Kennedy case. So whenever you get into this corridor, you become a target. And so the question is, are they going to destroy your reputation? In Garrison's case, they didn't assassinate him. They ruined his reputation and ruined his life. It's very interesting to note that in 1991, Oliver Stone did the JFK movie, and he got a lot of this out. In fact, they created something which was the Kennedy Records Act, which was release all the records back then, 1992. And they said, well, you have to release them within 25 years. Well, 2017 came around, and, you know, right in this very environment, I was doing a live stream, and I was going to release, you know, the records as they came out. And guess what? They didn't allow anything out, even though the deadline was there. So they waited until 2025, 8 years later, to release those records, and then they didn't let out the key records, as we're going to get into tonight, like the Joe and Eddie's files. So when people get into this corridor, and they either come in through, they can come in through a number of different places. You could be a reporter who stumbles into it. A lot of astronomers have got into it, and political analysts, social studies analysts, whatever it is, or wherever they happen to be coming from, you're gonna find this unusual backlash that takes place. And then suddenly you've got a list of unexplained deaths, or you have people who fall off the radar, or things just tend to go bad for them. And so the X-Protect group is very active. And as a buffer to them, there's something called X-Share. And we're going to get into the X-Share group later as we talk. But the X-Share group wants to use the same technology for moving things out there to the public.
Interesting.
So I'd say to kind of summarize it from here, mm-hmm. when you're looking at X-Protect, you're looking at a group that's dedicated to keeping the secrecy at any cost. And it doesn't matter who the target is, including the President of the United States. That's what the Kennedy assassination teaches us as a legacy. Here it is 60 years later, you know, and 61 years later, we get some records related to it. Mm-hmm. And the CIA, even at that point, is holding records back, the most key, important records, in my opinion. And I'll mention some of the records that came out and some of the things that we learned as a result. Now, I should say that there's a secondary group here involved, which is the X-Share group. Mm-hmm. And the X-Share group are much smaller, but you can see their footprints in history trying to move the culture forward, saying, here's the advanced technology. We do have the advanced technology, and let's share that with the public. And it is those people that we can track all the way back, for example, to 1946. And their presence in history. And it's very unusual because I count people like President Kennedy, for example, in that X-Share group, because we're going to find out the major motivation in the assassination was over the advanced technology and the fact that Kennedy wanted to share that UFO file with the Russians. So you can see we're going to go places the D-class never could.
What is the clearest evidence for a UFO connection to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and Senator Robert Kennedy in the 1960s?
It's important you mentioned Robert Kennedy there, because I think as the younger brother, his assassination doesn't get as much attention. But it's very interesting to note that he was on the road to being the next president of the United States. And we can only imagine the kind of retribution for that deep state with his own investigation into his brother's murder. He was the attorney general after all. And he was winning in 1968 when he was assassinated. And so there's a big aerospace footprint I'll mention there in his assassination. It's quite unusual. But in President Kennedy's assassination, there are a number of testimonials right off the bat. For example, the Watergate lawyer, Douglas Caddy, came forward on my program, Dark Journalist, and he said, he was close friends with E. Howard Hunt, who was the CIA super spy. And this is interesting because Caddy, you know, he's one of these figures who's a Watergate figure. He's a historical figure. So in a way, just from his background, what he says has a little more weight than if somebody were just to say this randomly. And what we get with Caddy's statement is this. He said he was best friends with E. Howard Hunt. And by the way, I talked to E. Howard Hunt's son, St. John Hunt, who told me, yeah, Caddy was my dad's best friend, and he was around, and I was growing up and all the rest of it. And he has a very deep background, starting in World War II with the OSS and then into the CIA. And he was the top CIA super spy. And so he got into trouble during the Watergate deep event, being part of the plumbers with Nixon. And Caddy was his lawyer. In fact, Caddy was the lawyer for the Watergate 7. It's a pretty, you know, kind of major place in history there. And so he's going to prison because they've realized the extent of the things that he's done. And before he goes to prison, Caddy, you know, they go out for Chinese dinner there in Washington, D.C. And they're talking about things. He's trying to get him to get into anything deep. And he's starting to reveal some things to him on the way out. So just as they're leaving the restaurant, he says, I have to know, Howard, what was it with the Central Intelligence Agency assassinating President Kennedy? Why was he assassinated? And so Hunt stopped and looked at his friend in private and said, John Kennedy was killed because he was about to give our most vital national security secret to the Russians. And Caddy was shocked. He said, Kennedy was going to give our secrets to the Russians? What secret are you talking about? And Hunt stopped and looked at him and said, the UFO file, the alien presence. He was going to share it with the Russians. Now, then he went off to prison, and Caddy probably never talked to him ever again. But Caddy wanted to go on the record with that, and he's a man in his 80s. Now a number of national security officials from that era have come forward. I talked to one of them, who really went on the record just recently, and he just passed away. He was an elderly man as well, but he was a national security staffer. His name is Malmgren, Harold Malmgren, and he passed away just in February. But what he put on the record, and he was, you know, God love him, he was putting this out on Twitter X and all the rest of it. But I talked to him, and what he said was, look, I wasn't directly involved with the UFO program, but I was briefed on otherworldly technologies. And he said it publicly. And then he said, when asked, do you think JFK was assassinated because he wanted to share the UFO file? He said, I think the number one reason why Kennedy was assassinated was the UFO file. It's another national security person on the inside. Kennedy was well briefed on the UFO file, and his history with the UFO file went all the way back to his time when the first Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, was his best friend. And Forrestal becoming the first national director of national defense, he took Kennedy, a young Jack Kennedy, all the way to Berlin in 1946 when Kennedy wasn't even anything. He wasn't in politics. He was a journalist. And so here's Kennedy walking through the ruins and hearing all these stories about how the Russians didn't believe Hitler was dead and all these types of things. And somewhere along the way, Forrestal sits him down and shares with him the UFO file story. And so Kennedy is already in the know on this subject. By the way, Forrestal will very unceremoniously be dumped out of a window at Bethesda Naval Hospital only a year after becoming the Secretary of Defense. He suffers from a bout of depression. And so it's a pretty interesting background with Forrestal, because what we understand from the Majestic 12 documents is that Forrestal wanted, he's part of the X-Share. He said, I don't think we should keep these secrets. We should share it with the public. And they're looking at him. He's the Secretary of Defense. The first one, by the way, we didn't even have a Secretary of Defense until him. So they merged after World War I and World War II. So Forrestal says, this is what I want to do. And he also, there's an episode, they say, where he went to look at captured bodies, that is, dead bodies from these crafts, and that he had some kind of a psychological reaction to this, telepathic link, whatever it would happen to be, but he realized we can't keep this secret. So Forrestal and Kennedy, that death of Forrestal out that window at Bethesda is quite interesting on Kennedy's side because it's a very close personal loss, and yet he's thinking, I know this guy was privy to these secrets that he was sharing with me, and I know he was one of the main people on this Majestic 12 group. So Kennedy and the UFO file, the interface goes back a long ways. And then if you go even further in there, you'll see Kennedy is part of the Office of Naval Intelligence during World War II. And when these incidents start to come up, he is somebody who gets briefed. So Kennedy already has that sort of background in exotic technology. We need to keep that in mind if we're to understand him and his assassination. And when you get to that point of him developing the space program, the moonshot, you know, and developing NASA to the level and saying, we choose to go to the moon, he is really taking that aerospace side on and saying, you know, the president in chief is who you answer to. And when it comes to the secrecy, we're also going to spread it with these other countries. Because in Kennedy's case, and we'll get into this later, but Kennedy, the main reason he wanted to share the UFO file was to prevent a nuclear exchange with the Russians. And it was to lower national security tensions in relation to that. And they had done a lot inside of that national security state to prevent the two from meeting, Khrushchev and Kennedy. And when they did, it's very interesting because Kennedy's like, I don't want any CIA people. I don't want any State Department people. I only want the translator. And you'll find this thing mimicked later with, for example, Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev and with Trump and Putin. And whenever it happens, everyone hits the ceiling. Oh, he's a traitor. He wants to meet with him alone. No, it's because if the two leaders exchange over the UFO file, they go around the whole cadre of the vetted people in X-Protect, the CIA, the State Department, that control structure over this very exotic technology. Mm-hmm.
And since we're talking about the UFO file, President Kennedy was headed to meet physicist Lloyd Berkner at the Trade Mart in Dallas when he was assassinated. Now, Berkner had been in Antarctica with Admiral Byrd, whose cousin D.H. Byrd owned the Texas School Book Depository. Berkner ran the Robertson panel and, after the assassination, said the speech that he was going to have given with Kennedy was going to have international implications, and they were going to fly in Air Force One. There was some kind of ceremony with the flag from the White House. So something major was planned there that didn't happen. I did an entire documentary on this just recently, JFK and the UFO file, the final speech. So you can see we're in deep territory here with JFK, Berkner, and the exotic technology trail.
Daniel, can you please tell me, why is secret aerospace technology at the heart of these federal secrets? What is the secret space program and breakaway X-Tech?
Now, isn't this interesting? Because here we are asking the kinds of questions that if we lived in the type of society that was actually open with these things, we would know. And I think an average person would say they could accept some secrecy because, you know, every government has secrets in order to compete with other governments. Mm-hmm. But the secrecy has become so overwhelming. That wall of secrecy has created a situation where the general public now has a schizophrenic relationship to the government because we can no longer accept blindly what they have to say. Mm-hmm. And on the media side, you know, there's a kind of superficial treatment of these topics, you know, the UFO file, executive action, the deep state, etc. They're dealing with it for pops and clicks and things, but they're not going into the deeper aspects of it. So what is it? Well, if you go back into that program, if you really look at the UFO file, you will find that in the late 1940s, we were redeveloping what appeared to be crashed craft from somewhere else. Now, whether it was from somewhere else or a very advanced group here goes into two different lines of thoughts. But in any case, it was far more advanced than our jet fighters and things along this line. So with that technology, which came on heavy in 1946 and 47, particularly is the year that it explodes, with the Roswell case and all these types of things. You know, the Kenneth Arnold sighting, and he's out there, he's flying, he's a very legitimate pilot with a great background, and he sees this incredible swarm of these craft. They're actually boomerang-shaped, even though we get the term flying saucer. And he said, isn't that interesting? The way that they're flying in formation reminds me of when I used to throw a saucer and it would skip across a pond. And so the guy who's writing the story, when Kenneth Arnold touches down, writes flying saucer. So this is where we get the whole terminology. And it's interesting to me, though, because there's something breaking there where they've just come out of World War II. So the question is, do they say, we're going to come to the public and say, there's a whole unexplained thing there. There are these craft flying around. They're far more superior, but don't worry about it, you know. Instead, what they decided to do was say, whatever it is that people are seeing is not a national security threat. Therefore, we don't need to talk about it. They didn't say it didn't exist. They said it's not a national security threat. Later, it became, oh, it's the planet Venus. You didn't see it. And it got worse, actually, after the original waves, because the waves were so overwhelming, if you go back to that period, that there are vast communities of people who were seeing these things. Now, why they were showing up in such numbers in that period becomes interesting also. And some of the questions that are raised are, when we exploded our atomic bombs for the first time, did that attract somebody's attention? It's quite possible. So there's a number of things, but also the German technology had taken us to a place. And I mentioned John Warner IV, who's a guest in my program, and he is the son of Catherine Mellon, who's the Mellon heiress of the Mellon banking family. And there's a lot involved, let's say, in that majestic aerospace side with the Mellon family. And we're going to find that out when we get to the heart of the congressional hearings, because there's a Mellon involved in the middle of that also. So, but one of the things that he talked about was a meeting with his grandfather, Paul Mellon, who is the son of Andrew Mellon, who was the Secretary of the Treasury and a real mover and a shaker in the government. And Paul Mellon is sitting there with a cocktail and musing to him about going over to Germany right after the war as part of the United States military, and said, you know, when we went into Peenemünde, which is the secret Nazi mountain base where they were developing all this advanced things like the V-2 rockets with von Braun and everything else. He said, I stood on a saucer. And when I stood on it, I looked out and it was, the diameter was a football field and a half. So that's 150-yard diameter. And we were able to retrieve that. Now, that's not, there's no kind of delineation in history where we go from the kind of planes that we fought with in World War II to that. So there's nothing of 150 diameter, a saucer, you know. So something very advanced was happening in Germany at the time. There's no question about it. The level, you know, of understanding is, were they working with crash retrievals? Were they ahead of us in relation to that because of this? So we have to look at it and say, regardless of where the technology came from, the problem arose in the late 40s after World War II, because they had this decision to make. And what they did is they put together a group, which is often referred to as Majestic 12, and they said, we're going to have them oversee this to make sure the secrecy never gets out, but also that there's some managing group. And the person who managed the group was Vannevar Bush, who was our top scientist inside the government. So the breakaway side of it is these people control a breakaway technology. I refer to the technology as X technology because there's steganography whenever they use it classically where they have the term X involved in all of the various advanced programs. And of course, you know, we laugh with something like, you know, the X-Files, and it's just kind of like the blow-off thing. But deep inside there is an actual program which used that steganography. And it was Bush who used it. And he actually uncorked a very ancient way of moving these programs through different government agencies by using this ancient naming system, which is the X steganography. So the X-Tech, the problem that they have with the X-Tech is there's a function of it that I refer to as apothium, which they call a reality distortion field. So when they get around these things, for example, when they had their scientists studying them, the scientists would go in there for 20 minutes and study some advanced craft that had been landed in Arizona or somewhere. And they thought, oh, we'll do a regular study of this. But within 20 minutes, they would start doing things like seeing relatives who had passed away. So the physics that are involved there have nothing to do with what we understand as physics. And it's funny because I spent a lot of time with Professor John Mack, who was a professor at Harvard, who gave up a lot of his own career in order to study UFOs. And at the time, he got a lot, he got hassled for it pretty heavily. This is the early 2000s, really. Mm-hmm. But what he said was, when I'm watching these abduction cases, you know, all these abduction cases, these people came to him, I was abducted by a UFO, that kind of thing. And he said, well, but they're going through things. They're going through walls. They're getting, their car is being lifted. Like, these are defying physics. Well, if you go into, and the more that I research the UFO file, those cases all involve a kind of alternative physics. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing about missing time and time stopping. So there's something operational there that if it becomes weaponized, becomes sort of the ultimate super weapon. So their excuse for hiding the technology from the public is the incredible advantage and saying, well, if somebody else gets their hands on that, you know, for example, the Russians are very close on our heels with it because they have their own crash retrieval programs. So they're saying, this is our reasoning for it. By the time we get to something like a breakaway incident, like the Kennedy assassination, that deep event, as I've proven, it's related to the aerospace technology, the exotic technology in the UFO file. That advanced technology and his willingness to share it made him a national security target. So this is the thing that something like a D-class committee would investigate. This is the problem that we arrive at again and again when you get around these things. If you do the superficial trail on the top, you'll end up with common things, as we've discussed. And they can always say, well, it was either this lone gunman who was, you know, upset at Kennedy and just got a lucky shot around Secret Service and all the infrastructure of secrecy, or it was anti-Castro Cubans at the time, you know, because Castro was such a target. Well, my question always when they get around the anti-Castro thing is, if they were anti-Castro and they couldn't assassinate him, how did they assassinate our president? It doesn't make any sense. So those explanations and the trails and the layers of narrative storytelling about them are complete bunk. If you look into the case, from the minute go, aerospace is involved because the shots that come from the building, the person who owned the building owned an experimental aerospace company, and that's D.H. Byrd, and we'll get into him as we go along. So I hope that answers the question, but when you get into the breakaway part, they show up in history. They sort of cause this damage, and then they retreat back into the shadows, and we're left to think, oh, you know, how did 9/11 happen, or how did the JFK assassination happen? There's a lot of things there that don't really add up when you're doing a regular investigation, and that gets us into dark journalism.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Now, you mentioned this earlier about the technology not necessarily following the laws of physics. We know that math, as we understand it, kind of breaks down. Do you think that what they're trying to protect is not so much the technology as is sort of the mechanisms of quote-unquote real physics?
Yeah. Well, when you introduce what your question reminds me of CERN and the Large Hadron Collider that's going on there, for example. So they're going into a different line of physics. I think on their side, they understand it. And they understand the reality distortion physics.
Yes.
But they don't want to share it. And this is where the problem comes in. You could say there are national security issues with sharing it. But after 80 years of captivity, you know, how much does that work? And the other thing is, you know, the way that a society works generally is one guy makes a scientific breakthrough, this other female scientist picks up on it, you know, this guy picks up on it, and that's how science progresses. If you take all the scientific advancement off the table, what are you left with? You are left with one small group, tiny group, with immense power operating inside of this national security structure. Mm-hmm. How much of the secret financing is involved with that? And how much of your society is set up around the secret financing? And, you know, tonight we're going to get into secret structures in relation to this. Now, here's a question. If you get the D-class committee, when they go into the UFO file piece, they're not going to touch anything about Apotheum. They're not going to touch anything about the deep physics involved. The only thing they're going to try to do is create either an open-ended conversation that says, oh, we don't know, you know, we haven't been studying it for 80 years, we don't know what it is, mm-hmm. which is totally false.
Right. Yeah.
Or they're going to say, you know, it's a threat. There's a UFO threat and we need a UFO threat office. That's the move. And all the people who are behind the UFO threat defense office, which they're attaching to the National Defense Authorization Act, that's billions of dollars every year that they want for this imaginary threat. Not that the UFOs are real, but the threat isn't real. Mm-hmm. So those people want to militarize the subject, and so they want to take the whole UFO threat piece. Mm-hmm. So it's crucial for us when we get these people before committees, they should be investigated. They should be interrogated for who put them up to the UFO threat side. Do you know what's happening with the D-class committees instead? Those very same people, and I'll name some of them here, Lou Elizondo, Chris Mellon, David Grush, and others, and I've interacted with these people for years, so I know their backgrounds very, very well. Those very same people, instead of being interrogated about the UFO threat and how they're trying to bilk billions of dollars out of the government, are advising the committees. So you have the counterintelligence wing controlling the congressional committee that's supposed to get the transparency. So as a ship goes, you know, you're going in the totally wrong direction. So either they turn the aircraft carrier of that investigative unit around, or it's just a sham for the public under the guise of saying, this is transparency, we're a D-class committee. And guess what? Of course, we have the best intel people telling us the UFO thing, the story about Kennedy, and it's all counterintelligence agents. And they're saying, yeah, trust these counterintelligence agents. And the counterintel people are saying, that government needs to give us the truth. But they are the government. The government pays them. Mm-hmm. And this is a long thing because one of the intelligence agents came out and said, I lost my job and I came out, I'm a whistleblower, you know, I can't get a parking space at Langley anymore. And he did all this stuff. And then I looked into his background and I found out with a very short investigation that he was getting paid by four different agencies in the government. And then when finally hit with that question, after all the softball interviews that he was given, he finally got hit with a real question by The Intercept. Mm-hmm. And they said, are you working for the government? And he said, yes, but it's not what you think.
But it's not the real government.
So this is who you're dealing with. But these are the people who, you know, are on all the podcasts, they're on Fox, they're in the intelligence committees, they are controlling the entire process. Mm-hmm. Because the Central Intelligence Agency has the entire thing in the palm of their hand. And the IC community, you know, they control so much of this. So when you get people from, you know, Fox News who go out and do their own podcasts, like a Megyn Kelly or whatever, you know, she's probably a very nice, smart woman. But she sits there and she rolls out these CIA people and she's like, today we're going to talk about UFOs. You know, you're not going to get the truth from counterintelligence people who are trained to lie about the UFO file, the most secret area of the entire national security state. So this is the nature of the problem that we face, and the committee itself becomes then a kind of a entertainment charade, which is deepening the wall of secrecy instead of getting at it, which is the executive order says, go after it, you know, release the records, get to the bottom of the truth.
It's like they're compromised by definition.
It is, right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you aren't cynical in relation to the government. I was totally open, by the way, when they announced this committee, and I gave them documentation about the people involved. And originally they seemed open to it. They were like, yeah, you know, we're looking at your information and all the rest of it. And then they shut down. Mm-hmm. So they know that they can only go so far because somebody is in the back saying, you notice how like the media and everyone else is talking about UAP, which is the marketing rebranding of UFOs. Well, somebody is in the back saying, UAP, gravy train, the money. Talk about, you know, UAP and the money's coming. Don't worry, just front it. And that's why you have all these Congress people who don't know anything about the subject, never subject, you know, spend any time on it. And they're like, we want to find out about these unusual, anomalous projects that are going on. The government is ill-informed but very greedy on that level. That's the superficial compromise level. And so that is the kind of dangle out there. And what you have is a weird battle in the background where there's just traces of the media, you know, on the independent side who can call it out. And we are one of the outlets who will do that. Mm-hmm. You know, so this program, with what we do with dark journalism, the first thing you do if you want to get at the truth of the UFO file is you don't have counterintelligence people involved. Simple. You want to get the best liar to give you the truth, you know? It's like asking a serial killer for, you know, a comfort and understanding.
I'm sure a serial killer would be able to give you a hug. Not so sure about the other thing. Thank you for that. What is the modern basis of the covert infrastructure of a parallel government system? How is it funded and kept secret from government oversight?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. At a certain point in this setup of the Central Intelligence Agency taking over exotic technology, there was a decision made somewhere along the line that we need something off the books. And so the black budget was created. But for years, it thrived in secrecy. And really, there's an article in the Miami Herald from 1987 that is the first reference in history to the black budget, which is an entirely secret system that is skimmed off of the income of different programs. So for example, a number of researchers that have come on my show have done investigations about missing money. Mm-hmm. And so they have missing money at NASA. They have missing money at HUD. They have missing money from the DOD, and every year...
The Pentagon?
Exactly. The Pentagon, the DOD, this whole infrastructure, they are failing the audits because what is going on with them? They're getting tremendous amounts of money. And one of the things I raised some warnings about in relation to the group that's controlling the UFO conversation on the Hill is what they're doing is they're attaching these UFO defense offices to the National Defense Authorization Act. And the Authorization Act is something that gives $1 trillion every year to all of our defense. So these people in the committees, if you attach something like a UFO defense office to it, as they have in the Senate Intelligence Committee for 2025, if you object to it and you say no, then they can go around and they say, oh, you're holding up $1 trillion worth of this money and it's not fair. Our servicemen will go hungry if you don't do this, you know, all these kinds of things, which is ridiculous because that's on a completely different budget schedule and nobody's going to go hungry with it except the military defense contractors. Mm-hmm. So they have a pretty good system there, but that NDAA has been used on a number of different occasions to slide through things and attach them. So for example, after the 9/11 emergency, we came under emergency powers. And we're still under the same emergency powers that happened during 9/11, the Patriot Act and all of those things. That's because the NDAA has attached to it the September 11th emergency. And every president, whether you're Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden, they all sign on the dotted line for the September 11th emergency because so much of this is about the utilization of emergency powers. So I guess structurally, in terms of the money, they have a very well-designed black budget system, but it is feeding a black budget infrastructure. And that infrastructure accounts for incredible underground construction, and it also accounts for incredible space programs that we know nothing about, that we refer to as the secret space program and the secret space architecture. This whole thing that's been going on since 1972 when it went black, so the last time we ended up going to the moon with the Apollo program is 53 years ago. Well, what happened in between? So they were like, oh, we're going back to the moon now. Where have you been for 53 years? You know, I mean, you've been making something out in space. Where is it? The public paid for it. So this is the nature of the problem. And if you go back, if you track it, and this is why the Kennedy aspect has to be understood as the kind of crucial linchpin about how we took this fork in the road off into the situation that we're in now. If you look at it, Kennedy was saying, NASA, you know, I found things where he's saying, why are there two space programs at NASA? One, Blue Gemini, which nobody even knows where it came from, and the other one that we recommended. Like, go to NASA, he sends his defense secretary, McNamara, and say, I'll kick this back to the military unless you get rid of one. Like, what are you doing? That program's secret. Who's operating it? The president wants to know who's operating a completely different space program. That's 1963. So what is it that's going on in relation to this now? There's a famous conversation that takes place between Reagan and Gorbachev. And this happens at a summit that's not very widely known. It's the Reykjavik summit in Iceland. And when they came out of that, everyone thought, you know, they haven't accomplished anything. They couldn't reach an agreement. And it was all because Reagan had a program called Star Wars. And it was the Strategic Defense Initiative. And originally the idea was it'll shoot down missiles, so there'll never be a nuclear threat in relation to this. Mm-hmm. So Gorbachev comes out, you know, in 2012, and he's at the New York Press Club talking with Charlie Rose, and he starts talking about this, and he says, you know, President Reagan took me aside during that summit at Reykjavik, and he said, will you help us with the UFO threat? And if we're attacked by these UFOs, will you work together? Can we work together? And Gorbachev said he was taken aback by the question, but he said, oh, yeah, absolutely. And then he turns to the people that are in the audience there, like Henry Kissinger and George Shultz and all these national security honchos, and he says, I'm sorry to have mentioned this, but it's a crucial thing for us to keep in mind that Reagan wanted our help to fight this UFO threat. Now, that's a conversation that took place between two leaders in 1987. So what is it that they're looking at? And how is it that something else is coming in the middle there and making sure that the Russians and the Americans don't talk to each other? It relates directly to the UFO, which is the problem that Kennedy had, which is that he wanted to share the UFO file with the Russians so we wouldn't have this issue. So there's something in the secrecy about whatever that exotic technology related to the UFO file is. This is what we're talking about. And that's why things like the D-Class Committee and the congressional hearings on this, if they don't go into Kennedy's relationship to the aerospace programs, or they don't go into the fact that Kennedy was assassinated over the aerospace programs, you're never going to get to the truth of any of it. Mm-hmm. And that goes for their UFO hearings, too. And as a matter of fact, I guess the ultimate slap on the Kennedy assassination and his legacy is to have CIA people running a UFO committee. That is the ultimate diss.
That is a kick in the head.
That's rich.
Daniel, can you please tell me what are some of the witness stories you would like to see the D-Class Committee explore in relation to the JFK assassination, even though 60 years have passed?
Yeah, there's a number of them that were kind of blacked out of history. They've been blotted out, as though were. There's so many to choose from. I'm going to choose two. The Ricky White story and also Judith Exner story, because they're both crucial to the aerospace side on this. But Ricky White, I'll summarize it this way. It's very interesting. Ricky was the son of Roscoe White. Roscoe White had a very unusual history. They didn't know much about him, but he was on the Dallas Police Force. In fact, he had joined the Dallas Police Force only 7 weeks before the assassination took place. And at a certain point, Roscoe becomes an unusual character in all this because nobody had guessed he had anything to do with the assassination. And then he dies mysteriously in 1971 in an explosion. And as his family is going through his belongings, they find something quite unusual. They find among his belongings, because he was one of the photo experts for the police as well, and he would do a lot of photo work for them. There's been a lot of controversy over the years about Lee Harvey Oswald and how he was framed with this picture. Mm-hmm. And Life magazine put it on the cover. And the picture, we're going to show it during this segment, but just for everybody to look at. But why don't you and I look at it anyway? And it's quite interesting because the picture shows, just give me a second to get that. There's a few of Oswald here. Would you hold that one and I'll hold this one. This is quite interesting. So that was the same picture that we're showing on the screen right now. And basically what it shows, and this is the picture that convicted in the public mind, you know, Oswald, which is, it's showing him in his left hand, he's holding the rifle that supposedly assassinated President Kennedy. In his right hand is a communist manifesto, and on his hip is a pistol, a revolver, which they will definitely say later that he shot a policeman with. So you got everything there in one picture.
Except I am guilty across his forehead.
Where's the tattoo?
Probably was too subtle.
Exactly. They were going for broke with this. There's no question about it. And I'm a madman. You know.
Guns blazing, literally.
Now, this second picture that we'll show on the screen is quite interesting. It is, in fact, the same picture, but it's like kind of 1960s Photoshop. And what it shows is the exact same background information and everything else, but it's a cutout. And it shows the same holding the rifle shadow and all the rest. As you can see, this picture is quite interesting because it was found among the possessions of Roscoe White after this explosion. And with his photography work, it tied him into the JFK assassination in a way that researchers became very intrigued with. Well, in 1990, with this story just lay dormant, they didn't know quite what to do with it. But in fact, it was picked up in the committee hearings in the late 1970s. The House Assassination Committee picked it up and looked at Roscoe White because they found out something else that was unusual. Roscoe White was in the same Marine unit with Lee Harvey Oswald, and he had gone over to Atsugi in Japan with him, and he had been recruited into military intelligence. Now, as we know, Oswald also was recruited into the CIA, but that's not public. So they're both at a top secret base there in Atsugi, which is like the Area 51 of Japan, developing the U-2. So Oswald is typically portrayed as kind of a slovenly guy, you know, beat his wife, worked for $1.25 an hour, was disgruntled, and just had to kill the president because. Well, if you go back into that history with him and Roscoe White, you're going to find he is, in fact, with a higher security clearance than many of the people on that base. And a lot of the people who came out later to talk about him, like Kerry Thornley, who were, you know, fellow Marines, they were like, oh yeah, Oswald had a higher security clearance than we did. Well, so much for, you know, this perennial loser that Oswald was. He has a high security clearance at Atsugi. So both he and Roscoe White are there, and then they're both there in Dallas right at the point of the JFK assassination. Remember, Oswald himself doesn't get the job at the Texas School Book Depository until 6 weeks before the assassination. Now, nobody knows that President Kennedy is going to Dallas at the time. It's not listed anywhere. And even the people on the inside haven't decided. The only people who know are the people who are shaping that on the inside for President Kennedy. They're putting together the Texas trip. And so Oswald getting the job, if he were this disgruntled loser, how lucky would you have to get to be a disgruntled loser who hates the president, who happens to get a job right on the limousine route that he's going to be by where you can shoot him from the window? That's pretty good luck for a guy, considering Kennedy hadn't even been to Texas since the election. So this is an extraordinary set of circumstances. But the other person that's there 8 weeks before the assassination is Roscoe White. Well, he'd been in the military this whole time, military intelligence. He comes in and he works for the police. Now he's there at the scene of the crime. And when the bullets go out of the window of the Texas School Book Depository in the classic story, the person who owns the building, as I mentioned earlier, also is a person who runs an experimental aerospace company. That company, by the way, LTV, Ling Temco Vought, will invest $3 million at that period of time in their advanced technology. And by 1965, which is only 2 years after the assassination, that $3 million investment is worth $55 million in 1965 money. So you're talking $500 million. That's a pretty good payoff just for using the center there. So I'm going to stick to White, even though there's something very interesting about the owner of the Texas School Book Depository we'll explore. So Ricky White is the son who grows up without a father, because in this explosion, as you know, a lot of people around the Kennedy assassination disappear. They die in some unusual fashion. And it's interesting to note that an actuary was polled and hired in 1971 to figure out what were the odds, the actual odds, of all the people who were witnesses to the Kennedy assassination dying in this mysterious fashion. And they had 36 of them listed there. There's a much larger number, actually, but just with the 36. And the actuarial result came back with this response. The odds of all of them dying by 1971 were 100,000 trillion to one. So they had a death list campaign there. There's no question about it.
Roscoe White was definitely on that. He knew too much. And I'm the only reason we know that is because very strangely, in 1990, Ricky White, Roscoe's son, comes out and said, I had a diary of my dad. And in his diary, he talked about his participation in removing a national security threat. There's the same language that Hunt was using about Kennedy. And as he moves through it, he realizes the dates and everything. It's the Kennedy assassination that he's a part of. And he puts it down in a diary, hides it, and it's in a cabin that the family owns. He goes to the cabin, he finds the diary, and he can't believe what he's discovering. And it's a 400-page diary with meticulous notes. Now, he comes out, and he goes directly to the FBI. And he says, not only that, there's a key here to a safety deposit box. I'm sure there's a lot going on with this. The FBI say, where did you get this material? What's going on here? And he said, I think my father was involved in the Kennedy assassination. So he said, you know, they said, bring us to the cabin, give us all the stuff. And he gives them all the stuff. And they said, give us the diary, too. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the Federal Bureau of Investigation who takes the diary. Right now we have an FBI director who's all in on the transparency, Cash mm-hmm. Patel. Mm-hmm. He can order, by the way, this diary to be retrieved because the FBI took it. They took it from Ricky White, and they never returned it. And so he asks them, he petitions them over and over again. He never gets the diary back. Finally, they say, we never saw a diary. Now, he was already doing television specials. His family had already seen the diary. Everybody already knew about the thing. The stonewalling of the FBI saying there is no diary is absurd. But they got away with it then. Eventually, they would say, oh, you know, that Ricky White, he was telling a story for money. Well, look, if he was telling the story for money, produce the diary and debunk it. But if you're hiding it behind FBI archives, then that's a totally different thing. Roscoe White is important because he shows that he's involved very deeply in the assassination plot. What we were able to learn from Ricky White's diary, from what he remembered, was that each of the positions and the various names that they gave to themselves, and his position was shooting in a certain particular portion of behind this fence. And of course, there's a number of things about somebody called Badge Man that come out in photography that show what appears to be someone in a police uniform shooting. That is Roscoe White. And Roscoe White was very deeply involved in the crime. And it's very interesting because the more we got into Ricky White's story about it, the more you realize, oh, there's a good reason they took the diary. This would look really, really bad and explode the case at the worst possible time in 1990 when they thought they had buried the whole thing. He was forced underground. He's gone completely off the radar. In fact, I've tried to reach him on a number of occasions. But Ricky White, his story can't come forward. However, the D-Class Committee has the power to petition Cash Patel to say the FBI took this diary of Roscoe White from Ricky White and go in and return it, produce it. So that's what a D-Class Committee can do. You know, instead of having a bunch of counterintelligence agents talk about this stuff or, you know, say JFK had an affair with someone who was in the mafia, you know. No, they've got a real case. Roscoe White was military intelligence and he had fixed this piece of evidence. They found it among his possessions. And the diary story, you know, for me, there are too many witnesses to it. The diary was real. The question is, you know, exactly what did the FBI do with it? The Ricky White story needs to be brought out. The D-Class Committee can do it. And my suggestion is that Ricky White himself would come out now after 30 years in hiding and say to the D-Class Committee, show up during one of the hearings and say, I'm here, you know, have Cash Patel give me the diary. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing that that committee can do. Remember, the committee's gone in September. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. You can't do anything. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get at those things in the government, it's a time-limited window. This is the stuff that they can do. And what we're seeing, there's a lot of fluff with this thing. As a matter of fact, what they're doing with a lot of the D-Class posters, and you'll appreciate this, is they're going, you know, they're showing Luna, who's in charge of the panel, who's a congresswoman from Florida, and, you know, God bless her. I hope she gets the job done. But she produced a JFK hearing that was one of the worst pieces of fluff I've ever watched in my life. It was terrible. Where they talked about, hey, they let out somebody's social security number, but the guy had died in 1969. You know, so, you know, it was useless. But anyway, they have these movie posters of her, and it's like, the D-class, you know, I'll get at the truth, and they show her face, and they have the whole thing. And everyone that comes out, they look like movie posters. So this is what they're doing with it. That has nothing to do with disclosure. It's a completely marketing effort on behalf of Congress, and it's going to look like, hey, we looked into the JFK thing, we released the records. Well, they didn't release the Joannides records. Joannides, I've identified on this program, it's a Washington Post reporter who brought him out. Nobody even knew he existed. Mm-hmm. And he's their top psychological warfare officer who created the Oswald operation. You think his records are important? I would say so, yeah. So he's the guy, if you track him through history, no one even knew he existed until 2005. He's dead now, by the way. But the person, he earned the Career Intelligence Medal, which is a rare achievement in the CIA. And the person who gives him the medal is Bobby Inman. Bobby Inman shows up in so much of my reporting because Bobby Inman is that interface person between the intelligence community and the exotic technology. And as a matter of fact, in 1990, Inman, after serving as deputy CIA director, NSA director, he was an admiral. He was friends with John Warner's dad. You know, John Warner's dad was the head of the Navy, and that majestic group all hung out together, the ones who handled the UFO file. Inman is the one who gets selected to give the Career Intelligence Medal to Joannides, because Joannides saved the UFO project from Kennedy's meddling. This is the nature of the problem. Inman, in 1990, comes out and says, you know what? Not only do we know what the UFO craft are, but we know who's inside operating them. That's a top Central Intelligence Agency figure on record. And he said it to UFO investigator Timothy Good, and he never went back on it later. Now, he ended up working at SAIC and all these very, very murky technology groups over the years. He's still alive. That D-class committee can subpoena him and ask him as a friendly witness or as a hostile witness to answer the questions about why the CIA gave Joannides the Career Intelligence Medal. I guarantee you, along with his many, you know, sort of infamous activities, that the reason they gave him the medal was because the Oswald Project saved the UFO file. And that's why Inman is there, standing there giving it to him. So the Joannides files not coming out is a big kick in the face to transparency efforts, because what it says is there is no disclosure. You get frill documents and you don't get the real thing.
Who is Judith Exner, and why is she such an important hidden part of the JFK story?
Exner is fascinating and lets out probably one of the biggest secrets in relation to JFK's past. It also connects in the entire entertainment world. She was very close with, you know, the Rat Pack, close friends with Frank Sinatra. She was an actress in Hollywood in the late 50s and early 60s, and you know, she had a famous actor husband that she divorced from, all this stuff. But she was right in there with that very, very deep echelon of entertainment bigwigs in that period. And, you know, she's absolutely beautiful and everything else, but it's through Frank Sinatra, who is hanging around the Kennedys in this period. Eventually, Bobby Kennedy gets rid of Sinatra, but that's another story. But he's basically saying, I have entree to organized crime. I can help you with certain things, you know, I have Las Vegas at my fingertips, let me get more and more in there. And in fact, Frank Sinatra handles the inauguration for President Kennedy. But he introduces Senator Kennedy on his way to running for president to Judith Exner. And Exner is a fellow Catholic like Kennedy, so they have a lot in common. She's intellectual and all the rest. And they become lovers, and over time, Kennedy starts to do something with her, which he says, I want you to take this package, and I want you to bring it on this train and go to this specific area, drop it off with this person, and leave it there. Don't ask any questions. And she starts doing it for him. And then they start doing it a lot. And there's something very interesting in JFK's background that's not talked about, which is what is called HUMINT. It is a human intelligence network. So how he got things around to a point where the State Department, the CIA, and these other clandestine groups couldn't get their hands on what he was doing. So, for example, Kennedy, in relation to Khrushchev, would say, I want to get a message to Khrushchev, but I don't want to go through the CIA and have them know what I'm talking about. So I write the message down, I put it in a newspaper, I give it to a journalist. He sits in a cafe in Washington, D.C. He closes the newspaper, he gives it to another journalist. That journalist picks it up, and they go to East Berlin. He's sitting there. Someone from Khrushchev's government comes into a cafe in West Berlin, and they interface there. He gives them the newspaper. The newspaper goes back, and inside of it is a message directly from President Kennedy to Premier Khrushchev. Well, that's a human intelligence network that he must have learned probably from his wheeler-dealer dad, who was such a Wall Street guy and, you know, a bootlegger and everything else, and ran Hollywood. I mean, Joseph Kennedy is a compelling story in himself. But nonetheless, Judith Exner comes up right in the middle of this, as Kennedy is using her as a 26-year-old actress and close mistress to him to get these messages around to different people. So she knows Sam Giancana, who is the big boss, the godfather of Chicago. And Kennedy starts saying, I want you to send this to Sam Giancana. And she's like, okay, you know, he's a mafia guy, he's a friend of Frank Sinatra's. If you sure want me to do that, yes. So she starts to get curious at a certain point. And it's very interesting because there's a big kind of hit job book on Kennedy that comes out at the end of the 1990s called The Dark Side of Camelot, where they try to show Kennedy as this womanizer. And, like, you know, basically the theme of it was the CIA was right to take him out, you know, that kind of thing. And it's interesting because it was written by a guy who was a fantastic author before he did that book. And then the CIA approached him and said, we can give you all this dirt on Kennedy, and you can put it out there. And right in the middle of it is Judith Exner, who was still alive. And she had a cancer diagnosis, and she decided, I'm going to tell part of my story. And she's telling things to this author with the idea of setting the record straight in history. What happened with Exner is that in the 1970s, she was called before these various committees because they figured out that she had visited the White House over 20 different times, and that there were FBI transcripts on her that were over 400 pages. So they were tapping her calls and tapping her calls with Kennedy. And so they were like, we have to bring her before committee. And she said, I'll come before your committee, the church committee, but you cannot release my name. And they said, okay, we'll do that. She comes, she gives her testimony. 5 minutes later, they put her name out there. And so she's surrounded by all these people. Now, Sam Giancana, who's the person she was doing the interface with, of sending these messages between Kennedy and Giancana, turns up dead immediately in the middle of all this. He was living like a king in Mexico with all that mafia money. They grab him through immigration. They stick him in Chicago, and they're like, you're up for some trial. And then they gun him down as soon as Exner shows up. Now, what she says, she was transferring back and forth. The author of the book is like, oh yeah, Kennedy's doing these mafia payoffs, what a dirty dealer, and all this stuff. Well, it's very interesting if you read what she actually said about what she was transferring. She's going on this train ride, and she decides at a certain point, I've been very good, I've never looked at any of these packages or talked to Jack about it, I'm going to look at one. So she opens it up, and she describes, inside of this book, Dark Side of Camelot, advanced aerospace blueprints. That's what Kennedy is transferring back and forth with this underworld figure. So the CIA is coming to this underworld figure and saying, behind Kennedy's back, we want you to assassinate Fidel Castro. Kennedy is getting the intel from the mafia guy who the CIA is going to, but he's also getting something else. Somehow, through defense contractors, Kennedy is tracking the advances in his own space program that they're keeping him out of. He's getting blueprints back, and that's what the payoff and the back and forth is all about. Kennedy's getting the deep intel that an underworld figure who's interfacing with the CIA can get for him. So she, by putting this on the record, brings experimental aerospace directly into the assassination. And over again, they try to use this interface with Giancana to say, oh, Kennedy, you know, he must have double-crossed the mafia and they did the assassination. Well, we already know that that's quite ridiculous because all the unusual things that happen after the assassination, the disappearance of the autopsy, the alteration of the autopsy, you know, the disappearance of Kennedy's brain, where you can't, you know, as a medical examiner, they can't find it, right? I mean, these aren't things the mafia can do. And the influencing of the media, the control of the Warren Commission, you know, the mafia can't do that. They operate on a different level of the deep state. So the Giancana story is very interesting because what it suggests is Kennedy's interface with that underworld had something to do with getting the real piece of the Ex-Protect defense contracting piece around aerospace. That's why it's so crucial and so important. Of course, she puts many things on the record there about how Hoover was tapping her calls and all the rest of it. Now, it's quite interesting to note that in the middle of all this story, there's a file that comes out of the FBI, and they're watching Exner's apartment, and they see two guys who look like twins breaking into her place, ransacking the whole place. They go in themselves afterwards, and they realize they haven't taken anything. No jewelry's gone. There's even money here that they haven't taken. They were looking for something else. Well, the timing, the overlap of the timing, has to do with a defense contract for the TFX experimental fighter. This is a long story in itself, but to sum it up, basically this. They were trying to blackmail President Kennedy, the group that was breaking in. They were the sons of the CEO of General Dynamics, which was the high-tech aerospace company. And they wanted to basically blackmail him with the information they would find at Exner's. And the FBI recorded it. They didn't stop them from breaking in. They were trying to lay back and say, what's going on? And they never prosecuted them for anything. One of them eventually, one of those twins, went completely insane and started a group in Alaska and, you know, was convicted of incest and all that. I mean, they are not
keeping it in the family.
Yeah, the twins were a little bit, you know, the sons were very, very dicey characters. I'll tell you a weird thing, too, because whenever I get around these details, it's very odd. But those same two sons of this CIA general contractor, General Dynamics contractor, the two sons who broke in, if you look into their background long enough, you'll find that at the age of 16, they're involved in a fight at Beauregard High School with Lee Harvey Oswald. So, you know, this trail of contractors, intelligence people, how did they even know Oswald? Well, they both went to the same high school, true. But, you know, when you get to the overlap of what's happening here, just like when we get to the overlap with what Exner was doing, you know, there's much more to the story here, which is why when we get around Oswald, which is where we'll take this after your next question, Oswald is at the heart of the UFO enigma. And so I'll take your next question, then we'll do Oswald, if that's okay with you.
No, of course. So tell me, what is the difference between UFO and UAP disclosures, CIA whistleblowers and DOD billionaires promising to reveal the UFO threat just to create a UFO UAP defense office?
This is the crucial thing. In fact, that's the crux of what we're talking about, because what they're trying to do now, after sitting on the technology for 80 years, is redirect it. So this breakaway group just kept the breakaway technology. They're trying to break back in, and they're trying to say, they need a story, though. It says, yeah, we developed this advanced technology. We did it with your money. We didn't tell you about it. But don't worry, we were doing it because there's a UFO threat. And those billions that we're asking for to do this or to protect you. So that's the story that they need to put across. The leader of the group that's putting this across is Chris Mellon, who is the cousin of John Warner, I mentioned. And Warner, in our discussions and interviews, and he's gone on the record with this, with his own work. He said, well, you know, my cousin Chris Mellon, you know, he's part of this UFO threat operation that you've identified. And Mellon, you know, a number of the whistleblowers came back to me and said, yeah, I want to tell you about this, tell you about that, but I can't because Chris Mellon won't let me talk to you. And I started to realize, oh, Mellon's behind the whole thing. If you dig into Mellon's history, he's known as the mayor of Area 51. He oversaw the secrecy at the most secret facility for a decade. He's the one who's running UFO disclosure now. So I found a quote from digging through the records of his that says the following, and I'll put it up on the screen here. And I'll read the quote, but basically the thrust of it is this. There are no UFOs, the government isn't hiding anything, and there's no advanced technology program that the public doesn't know about. It's all completely a myth. That's Chris Mellon in 2016. In 2017, a New York Times story comes out. Oh, there are UFOs. Chris Mellon is right in the heart of it. He promotes a group that's run by the CIA called TTSA, To the Stars Academy. And they recruit the rock star, Tom DeLonge, to be the front man for the whole thing. He goes out and says, yeah, there's UFOs. The government needs to give us the truth. All the people behind the company, the CEO, you know, the chief of operations and everything else, all career intel people. They're all career CIA people. In fact, one of the guys is a 25-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency at the directorate level, the top guy. So that whole wave of UFO whistleblower disclosure that created these committees and this push for money in the UFO Defense Office comes directly from Chris Mellon, who is the mayor of Area 51. So that's not who you want running this. The other problem is, Mellon is a billionaire DOD official trying to control UFO disclosure. And he's managing these whistleblowers. So these guys come out and they say, well, I saw this, I saw that, I'm coming forward to the government. And he says, this is what you're gonna do. Here's how we'll do it. And he created something called the UAP Defense Fund, which is basically gonna be a large scale just slush fund for people to roll in money into this effort. So Mellon has squeezed that entire process. He's installed intel people around the whole disclosure community and the whole disclosure office. So if we don't smash the Mellon op, you don't get UFO disclosure, you get CIA, UFO threat, emergency powers, and all the rest of it. That's the corridor that this goes down. And Mellon was getting so frustrated at my efforts that when we shot a documentary that included him and I included this Grush story, he went crazy on social media and was like, that journalist, you know, he doesn't know and all the rest. He started to flip out and everyone was like, you know, this guy's usually cool, calm, and collected. The reason is because we struck at the very heart of what he's doing. And the other problem that he needed to make up for is that David Grush, who's the lead whistleblower in all this, in conversation with me, he reached out to me, you know, we had a normal conversation and I talked to him and I said, look, just put this stuff on the record, come on the show. And he said, I can't do that. You don't understand. Chris Mellon won't let me come on your show because, and I'm afraid of the backlash. So Mellon completely controls that whole thing, because if he were a free whistleblower giving information to the public, he'd just come on the show and say, this is what I saw in those records when I was at the NGA and I'm behind, you know, this disclosure happening. Instead, Chris Mellon, some weird billionaire DOD official who ran Area 51, is saying, you can't say anything, don't talk to him. So, you know, this is the, that's what's really going on. Now, Mellon is embedded in the UAP disclosure D-class. You know, that whole thing that they're gonna have with the hearing, the D-class is gonna include Mellon, Grush, Elizondo, all the counterintelligence people, as I mentioned. So you're either gonna get one or two things. You'll get CIA false UFO threat disclosure, or you'll get the real thing. There is no middle ground, it's one or the other. And if you have a bunch of counterintelligence and agents running that committee, that's what you're going to get. And right now, Luna, who, you know, everyone had hopes for with this, and Burchett, who is a Tennessee congressman who's been like, we need to get to the truth on this and all the rest, I had hopes for them when they came out with this, and I even communicated with them. Now, all their people, you know, all the staffing is counterintelligence people. That's where the D-class sits. Unless it turns around, that's what we're looking at. And that is a worse condition than no disclosure, which is false disclosure. And it is a lie about a threat to build a billion-dollar industry of a UFO defense organization that can respond ultimately and activate emergency powers. Because the tryout for things like this in December, for example, of last year and January of this year, we saw a big drone explosion. No one knew where all these drones were coming from. Well, that sky event of these drones showing up and nobody knowing what was going on is good for data mining for that type of program.
That's amazing. What is the Continuity of Government Emergency Powers Program? What is COJ? And when was it created? How does it relate to deep underground military bases?
Continuity of Government program is the most secret program in the government beside the UFO file. The two are twain in that regard. And what we're looking at is an entire infrastructure that has been built to survive a cold nuclear war back in the Soviet Cold War days. And we did it in America and cost billions and billions of dollars to build up an incredible underground infrastructure. And the infrastructure is complete and that resulted in a number of deep underground military bases. Originally, it had a great purpose, which is if we had a nuclear exchange with the Russians back then, we would most definitely need a secondary government that could call the shots after this annihilation had occurred on the surface. What happened over time, though, were the things that were developed for it were misused. And that misuse became a problem. So when it was misused, for example, to build up a doomsday network, they had a network that was outside of any communications that could be tapped into. And so that doomsday network created this structure that they were able to utilize in deep events throughout American history. It was utilized, the network was utilized during the Kennedy assassination. The White House Emergency Office, COG, was used by Secret Service agent Winston Lawson. He used the communication. Nobody explained or knew why he had used it. Winston Lawson was part of the Continuity of Government program. John Dean in Watergate is the lawyer for President Nixon, but he's the one who burns him before the Congress. Well, you know how it goes with your own lawyer. Your own lawyer doesn't need to testify against you. But John Dean does, and he takes Nixon down. John Dean had just come out of 3 years of working for the Continuity of Government program. When you go into the 80s with Iran-Contra and the Reagan-Bush administration, when you go later into 9/11, it's all Continuity of Government personnel. Dick Cheney and Dick Rumsfeld, they were called in the 1980s to create a new version of COG that wasn't just for a nuclear emergency, but was for any emergency. For example, for UFO threat. So I can then snap my fingers, turn on Continuity of Government, and then the government gets taken over by the NORAD NORTHCOM commander. Right now the guy's name is General Guillo. And he will assign then regional governors for each part of the United States. So there's no more Congress, there's no more presidency, because the rule inside of COG is if the switch gets flicked, then he becomes the combatant commander. And he has to restore the situation until elections can be called again. Well, you know, that doesn't work out so well. Once people grab power, they don't usually give it back. And yet, every year, we sign on to the emergency powers that are there. Every president signs on to it, as we mentioned in the NDAA. So the Continuity of Government built up a vast underground bases network. They funneled billions of dollars into that program. And you and I were talking about various people that I've encountered who have been in those bases. Well, it's a vast underground infrastructure, and they control that infrastructure. And I think at a certain point, because of the lack of oversight, it became, that's what goes into that breakaway piece. And so it becomes harder and harder because they say, well, you know, nobody can ever get into COG, Continuity of Government. It has to be just the highest echelon level of the most carefully vetted cadre of deep state actors. And so there you have the president right there sitting in the middle of all that, and they can remove him with the flick of a switch. That seems unusual for a constitutional republic, right? So in short, the Continuity of Government came up rather dramatically during the COVID incident, especially when President Trump and the first administration got COVID. And suddenly Nancy Pelosi was like, I was just briefed by continuity of government, COG. Well, it's interesting because after Trump lost that election, he fired Mark Esper, who had just changed the COG commander. And it's my suspicion that he realized that they were going to replace the presidency, or they had considered activating COG to do that at that point. That's why after losing the election, you would fire a defense secretary. That doesn't make any sense. So then he went in, Trump, and he found something called NSAM 57, which was sitting on the books, which was something that President Kennedy had left. It's an executive order. And Fletcher Prouty, who had worked, is a character that worked between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA back in the Kennedy era. He said what happened was Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, wanted to take all paramilitary power from the Central Intelligence Agency. No covert operations, no military operations. All you do is collect intelligence. So that's defanging that entire process. And he put something on the books, National Security Action Memorandum 57. And Prouty said, the Joint Chiefs looked at it and said, do you want to go into all-out war against the CIA? We can't do this. And he said, that's the presidential directive. And they shelved it. A little later on, he's assassinated. That's the end of it. So somebody in that Trump apparatus on the defense side knew that this thing existed. And before Trump left office, they activated it. Now, as soon as Biden came in, the thing disappeared. But it was active for like 8 days. So this is the thing, the clandestine activation of these powers that goes on in the background on a regular basis. The danger with COG, and it should be investigated by the public, is we don't know anything about that infrastructure. We don't know about the interface or where the billions of dollars are disappearing to in that program. So very much like the UFO file, it is secrecy rules. And unfortunately, we've had that problem in the government since the National Security Act of 1947.
Well, build you a story to read to your children before bedtime. Type of situation.
It's prepping a narrative, exactly. Yes. But that's where we are. And it's interesting because how do you get the truth in circumstances like that? I mean, you know, what are you going to do when that apparatus is that tight and it says you can have this much? The executive order says all. It says all the records pertaining to the Kennedy assassination. Well, the way they get around it is very interesting because the order, the law that came up in 1992 after the Oliver Stone movie, it said this is what we need to do. We need to create in Congress the ability for them to release all the records pertaining to it. And it was a 25-year, it's a law, it's not a suggestion. They didn't release it in 2017. Now, with the executive order, the Trump administration, the beginning of this year, they released everything, but they didn't release the Joannides file. And the loophole is this. The records that were covered by the original law and act, no one even knew that Joannides existed. And so they didn't find out his existence until 2005. Therefore, he wasn't included in the original batch, so they have a loophole and they say, you're not going to get his records. Well, the executive order says all the records. So what are you going to do? How is a D-class committee going to go forward with something like that if you don't produce the George Joannides records? You haven't produced anything. You've produced a lot of records of correspondence of CIA agents back and forth. And it's interesting, it shows certain CIA agents lied under oath relating to the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. Well, big surprise, right? So, you know, this is the nature of the thing. So either if you're in the business of getting at the truth and you're hiding the truth, then you get out of the business. So the D-class committee either produces the truth of the Joannides records or fold the committee. Who needs it? You know? But they should be compelled by the executive order because that's a law. So there we have it. It's a presidential directive based on a 1992 law that you need to release that information by 2017. And it's very interesting because, you know, there's this Judge Napolitano character. He's a libertarian judge. He does all these kind of TV things. And he said at the end of the first Trump administration, he was talking with Trump, and he said, are you going to release the Kennedy records? And Trump said to him, no, I can't release the Kennedy records. And Napolitano said, well, you don't want to treat the American public like children, you know. What are you doing? And he said, no, you don't understand. If you saw what was in the records, you couldn't release them. Now, the 80,000 records that they've put out don't show anything on that level. So my suspicion is it's the Joannides records that he's talking about. And that Joannides, who was their top, remember, their top man for psychological warfare, that he used that psychological warfare to cover up the Kennedy assassination. That's the problem. And the D-Class Committee, by their designation, is compelled by the executive order and by the 1992 law to produce them both. And if they don't, then they're outside the law. They're operating completely outside of any kind of legal standard.
This is incredibly compelling. Can you tell me, how did the task force committees for investigating political assassinations and secret, unidentified, anomalous phenomena end up being staffed and advised by self-identified counterintelligence agents?
And this is the counterintelligence problem that we have throughout the government and throughout the UFO disclosure community. There's a big problem there because if somebody is in a government program, they can always come out and say, I saw this in that program and I'm a whistleblower. But, you know, a real whistleblower doesn't get TV shows, you know, millions of dollars from military contracting. Those aren't real whistleblowers. So they've taken the name, they've absconded with the idea. And they learned inside of Congress that they don't know anything about the UFO file on the congressional side. There's no Congress people. But they all love to talk the UAP UFO game. And they came up with this term UAP, which is unidentified aerial phenomena, because they wanted their own marketing version of UFO. I think it's a stupid name. UFO is what we're talking about. It's the same thing.
So much better. It's so much better. I'm sorry.
Let's get real. But I think the tragedy of the whole thing, in a nutshell, is this, which is those Congress people who are like, hey, we're being open, we're being transparent, we're covering UFOs, all the people that they're utilizing are the people who are like, oh, we have to get the truth out of that government, but the CIA, the NGA, the NSA, that's who's paying their bill. So and we've had to show this over the course of a few years. Mm-hmm. So you still have people that are in this fog, that CIA counterintelligence people, who are trained, they're the best trained liars on planet Earth, period. Because the idea of counterintelligence is you're trying to fool another country that you're doing a particular thing. Counterintelligence is like World War II, when the Allies had a fake out that they were landing in Africa instead of Normandy. You know, and so they created this whole thing so the Nazis would believe they were landing somewhere else. That's what counterintelligence is. You play with the head of the enemy. In this case, they've taken the counterintelligence rules and they've taken them on against the American public. So the American public is the one who's being fooled with the counterintelligence narrative. So you have to get all those people out of it. And the only way you can do it is by starting from scratch and calling forward genuine experts and people who really want to get to the real truth around disclosure. Because I'll tell you something about disclosure. You can't have disclosure on a government level. You will never have disclosure at a government level. It will not happen. The only thing you can do is achieve disclosure on a citizen level with citizen groups tracking it, and then force the government after your own disclosures to come forward and mirror what you've created. That's the way it works. Otherwise, you hang around waiting 61 years for the JFK records to come out.
That's true. You have to corner them. In your opinion, is the D-class task force that's headed by Luna compromised and just a PR exercise for the government to appear transparent?
Absolutely. The problem is it doesn't have to be. And I don't think that someone like Luna or Burchett are necessarily compromised. The problem is they're listening to the wrong people and they're being staffed by this group of people who've been around, by the way, for the last decade doing this. And they've been trying to find a way in over and over again. One of the things they wanted to do was force the Trump administration to create a UFO czar, and they wanted to use the most compromised guy, Lou Elizondo, right in the heart of it. We did a series of reports on it and everything else, and everyone was said, oh, well, you know, of course you have to get a counterintelligence guy to do this. Who else is going to know anything about it? It's a totally wrong approach. You need a citizen investigator who doesn't have any of those ties to the defense contractors. Now, it's very interesting. I'm going to say this about Elizondo. Very recently, a week ago, he holds up a picture at this UAP Congress while he and Avi Loeb, who's a Harvard astrophysicist, who's right over here at Harvard, asking now for $1 billion just for the two of them to explore UAPs, okay? And Avi Loeb comes out of Talpiot, which is Israeli intelligence. Mm-hmm. So he's like the Israeli version of a CIA asset. So these are the people running the thing. Now, he holds up a picture and says, I've just been given this picture, you know, and it's a classified picture, but I'm declassifying it and all this stuff. And then he says, you know, it clearly shows a UFO and all the rest of it. He's done this before. Within 24 hours, the picture is debunked as the most banal excuse. Now, those people on the NGA, CIA side, all of those people have access to the greatest things, and they could produce the best UFO videos, the best UFO film, pictures, everything. For him to put out something of this nature is such a strange, unusual thing to do. It was debunked instantly, and he got a lot of heat for it. But this is the weirdness of that whole field, of what's going on, that this guy would hold up a fake picture in the middle of all this. It's almost as if there are movements inside of that group to replace who's the main money asker. And they're telling this guy, hold up a phony picture because we want to move along to this other guy who can really get the money for us. So in any case, from my side of the spectrum, you know, we've been basically validated by saying Elizondo was up to no good, and here he is waving a phony picture for $1 billion. I mean, that's, you know, that's some kind of UFO OnlyFans that you can only get in the counterintelligence universe. So I think when you're looking at there is, it's an incredible grab for the money. If that committee is advised by the counterintelligence agents, and if they're advised by that whole kind of ex-protect wing, then you're going to get, you know, it would be better not to even have the committee because you're going to get a staging ground for them to launch a UFO threat operation.
It's a lot to consider there. Yeah. But in that last sentence.
It's problematic.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
The implications. What will happen if the covert intelligence services continue to hijack the D-class process and the Congressional Task Force, and the special access programs remain secret from the American public that funds them?
This is the nature of the problem, and it's the road that we're going down. Mm-hmm. The special access programs, the secret programs, those relating to the UFO file, they're not reaching the public. We're getting this weird fluff. The jellyfish video is another one that they put out. And the jellyfish video is interesting because it takes a particular talent, I think, on behalf of the government to do this. They leak it out, and TMZ gives the host a show to do all this stuff about it. About 9 months later, it's found out to being like a floating bag or something like that. Now, as I've said, there's a real UFO file. They have the best video. They have the best stuff and the greatest archive on their side. And they put out the most trite things, including the Tic Tac video and all the stuff that's supposed to have changed the conversation around UFOs. What they're trying to do is put the UFO subject under the umbrella of this wing of the government. Instead of having citizens come forward and saying, I took this picture, or I had this experience, or I was abducted by this, now there's a whole new wing of the Central Intelligence Agency that comes forward and says, I am a CIA agent who's been abducted. And John Ramirez is one of them. Jim Semivan, who's the top CIA guy who launched TTSA. Oh, I've been abducted by aliens. This is what they're saying. So they want to take over that narrative too. So if you were thinking, I want to learn about the alien subject, I want to know about the UFO thing, it's all being rechanneled back to these UFO people. And I'll tell you something, from Reddit to UFO Twitter, UFOX, and all the rest of it, they're all lapping it up as if these people are the real deal. So you're in a very, very, I'm sort of sounding a warning bell for that D-class committee, that if they don't get to the bottom of this, that these groups are going to not only soak the American public for billions of dollars, but they're also going to get their hands on the machinery to launch a false UFO threat. This is the nature of the problem. It's the same problem and the same danger if you go back to the Kennedy era, the very same thing he warned about, which is that the situation that they were in could be seized upon, you know, in that case, the Cold War, to create an announced need for security. And, you know, Kennedy got into big trouble with them in that speech. The other thing that he said in that speech is, we can't afford to fight a nuclear war where even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the anathema part to the deep state, who felt, no, we're the superior ones, we can do whatever we want. And so when Kennedy gives that speech in June of 1963, he's earmarked for assassination. I want to mention, I put together a 198-page binder for Congress. One of the things that it included was the outer space cooperation memo from President Kennedy, which sits at the Kennedy Library, and calls on November 12th, 10 days before his assassination, for the head of NASA and others to look at doing a joint moon mission with Russia and to share that information with the Russians. Mm-hmm. And then on the same day, he sends a memo to the CIA director, and it says, share all the high threat cases with our Soviet counterparts relating to the UFO file, because I don't want them to mistake anything that they see flying over their bases for us flying over their nukes and to set off World War III. Those are the instructions that he gives 10 days before the assassination. If you're investigating President Kennedy's death, you have to go to the aerospace aspect and the ex-protect groups that are controlling that information and look at his actions in the final days of his presidency and how transformative it is, if you think about Kennedy. What kind of a world would it be if he had disclosed that? That would have snuffed out the Cold War. There wouldn't have been any Vietnam and all the rest. Mm-hmm. And you'd have an understanding of this exotic technology coming from, okay, it's an open question, God knows where. If it is from an off-world civilization, that's something pretty dramatic for humanity to have. And if it's not, this is the knowledge that we need to possess. President Kennedy, in the middle, is the transformative figure, and it's why they held the records for 60 years after they got rid of him, and got rid of his brother, the Attorney General, who was going to become president. And we have an echo in RFK Jr. being in the current administration. There's that Kennedy influence again, very controversial, very attacked by the deep state. It's still, that wing is still there, and the aerospace forces that have consolidated so well, they don't want to give up that power.
Who would? Power is a very
rarely
difficult.
Given back for free, all right?
Very, very difficult to give back, very difficult. Now that we have all of this information, what is something that the D-class committees could do and show and say in order to earn the trust of the public, considering so many of their agents are counterintelligence agents?
It's an excellent point. This is the thrust of it. And I don't want to be just totally cynical about it. As I said, when the committee came up, I was totally open to what they could do, especially since some of the records came out. Well, that's a start. The problem is that it's been hijacked in the meantime over the past few months. Now, what they could do is very simple. First, you go straight to the aerospace aspect. So when you hold the UAP hearings, you go to the Kennedy assassination. That's number one. Because if you want the key to the enigma of the UFO file, you go to why the president was assassinated. You combine the two things that they're investigating, in fact. Because remember, that D-class committee, they have four sets of hearings. The JFK assassination, MLK, and RFK assassinations. Because all that information's been held back for how long?
Too long.
Yes, six decades. Now, the UFO file, forget it. It's been a shifting sands. We've gotten no truth out of any of that. And they've come up with various explanations. In fact, they whitewashed it until 2017 when they came up with the UFO threat idea. And they were like, now's the time, the public believes in it too strongly. In fact, if you look at 2017, you're going to find the top Google search in that period was UFOs. And that's when they looked at it and said, this is the time. because everyone's so interested in that. Let's do that. And they decided, we're going to change it all. So they took the mayor of Area 51, Mellon, and said, you're going to be the poster boy, and you're going to run all the whistleblowers and run the UFO file. So, you know, they took that poster boy, and he ran the UFO file whistleblowers, as we've said. Now, what they could do, if they go to the aerospace side, one, if they release the Joe Anitti's records, and they bring Bobby Inman before the committee, Inman, the top inside player, former deputy director, CIA, his background, the blackest of black ops. And yet, he showed in 1990, as I mentioned, that he was willing to talk about the UFO thing before, he got shut down. And what did he say? He said, we know what UFOs are and who's operating them inside. That's what you get him to testify. He's alive. He's in his early 90s. He came to our secret space program conference. He's there. All you have to do is call him before that committee, and if he says, I don't want to answer, you treat him like a hostile witness and subpoena him to make sure he answers. Mm-hmm. You have a number of people involved with this. Ruth Payne is a very interesting, enigmatic person in relation to the JFK assassination who's still alive. And the only thing I want to say about Ruth Payne is this. She was the wife of Michael Payne, and they were the ones who let the Oswalds stay with them when they came back from Russia. Michael Payne was working for a very interesting person in that period. He was at Bell Helicopter. The person who was in charge and who was his mentor was Walter Dornberger. Mm-hmm. Walter Dornberger was the person who created the Nazi rocket program. We brought him over through Paperclip, and you know, Dornberger was slated for judgment at Nuremberg. He was going to be hanged for using slave labor while building the V-2 rockets. Wernher von Braun, who became in charge of our NASA rocket space program and got us to Mars, I'm sorry, got us to the moon, probably got us to Mars.
I'm sure he helped.
Talk about secret space. He said, look, you can't kill him, because he's part of my, if you want me to do what I'm going to do for your space program, save him. So they rescued him. And the first interrogation notes of Dornberger are like, he can never be reformed. He's too much of a Nazi. He would never be reformed. He really believes in it. Forget it. But they brought him over here, and he became the head of Bell Aerospace, Bell Helicopter. Michael Payne was his understudy, his protege, as a physicist working there. And what happens? Lee Oswald and Marina Oswald end up staying at Michael Payne's household. And all the evidence that convicts Oswald, including the backyard picture, comes directly out of Michael Payne's household, who's working for Dornberger. So Dornberger is part of the paperclip program that takes over NASA, and that whole idea, the Nazi idea of ruling things on the ground from space, gets integrated, that Marshall philosophy gets integrated into her own space program. Mm-hmm. It is the aerospace key in the heart of all this. Only the D-class committee, the only way that they could get at the truth is by getting directly to Dornberger, getting directly to the NASA aerospace element in the assassination, and also getting rid of and exposing the UFO threat operation being run by DOD billionaires like Mellon. That's what the D-class committee can do, and if they do that, it would be historic. If they don't, and this becomes an exercise in PR for the UFO threat, we could find ourselves in a very dangerous position in the world.
Without a doubt.
There's no question about it. Now, I hope things go in another direction, but seeing all those influences on those committees, my feeling right now is they need a very strong message to be sent back. And I think we've done some of that here tonight.
I hope so. And we'll see what happens and discuss it.